I'm going to continue a little bit on the thing I was talking about yesterday. I was talking yesterday at BF East. BF is everywhere now, west, east, expanding all the way around, which is very nice, actually. It's very good. And what I was talking about yesterday was basically about the Buddha. What does the Buddha mean for us? What is the importance of the Buddha? And it's actually very useful to be able to think about the Buddha in the right way. If we think about the Buddha in the right way, it becomes an inspiration. And it makes the Dhamma real. We understand what the Dhamma is all about. And it becomes something very powerful, the force for good in our life. But if we think about the Buddha in the wrong way, it can almost be something which holds us down and doesn't lift us up, doesn't carry us forward. And the reason for that is because if we lift the Buddha up too high, so he becomes like a God figure or something kind of, we cannot really touch, something different from us, we cannot relate to the Buddha anymore. And his teachings become something which somebody who is completely different teaches to us. And there's no relationship between us and the Buddha. But if the Buddha is a human being like us, which of course he was, then we can relate to what he's saying, right? His life story becomes an example that we also should emulate. And that is the power of thinking about the Buddha in the right way. That's why I want to discuss a little bit today about who the Buddha actually was. What is it that makes him special? And what is it that makes him into, an ordinary person in many ways, but a special ordinary person? And one nice way of looking at the Buddha, one of the things that always occurred to me, is that we often talk about the idea of genius, right? People are very intelligent and very smart, and we tend to elevate and celebrate people who are intelligent in our world. And the more intelligent they are, the more wonderful and marvelous they are, right? The real geniuses, the kind of the Nobel Prize winners and these kind of people, we sort of look up to them and, wow, these people are amazing here. Of course, there is some truth to that. You know, if somebody is very bright, then they can do good things for the world, right? And the first thing, if you are very smart, the first thing you can do is you can have a good life for yourself, right? If you're intelligent, you can make money, you can get some status because you get a good education. And of course, everybody wants that. So there's something to be said for being reasonably intelligent. Nobody wants to be a complete dum-dum, right? It's not very... It's not very useful. But from a spiritual point of view, you can perhaps be dum-dum and still actually have a good life. So this is actually a very different way of looking at things. But first of all, yes, there is something to be said for being intelligent, for being a genius. You can generally have a better life yourself if you do that. And of course, also, if you are very intelligent and you can be a Nobel Prize winner or whatever, you can also help humanity, right? You get a Nobel Prize in medicine, which means that you can help people lengthen their life, reduce the diseases in the world. And of course, that's also a wonderful thing to be able to do. But at the same time, it's fairly limited, right? It's only so much. Okay, so let's say you discover some wonderful new drug. It means that, 1% of the population is going to live a bit longer. Great. So you get an additional, few years on your in your life because of that, which is very useful. But unless you spend that life in a good way, unless you use that time in a good way, it is very limited. It can only do so much for you. I remember when Steve Jobs died a few years ago, I think it's 2 years ago or something now, when he passed away, I remember some of the headlines in the newspaper was something like, "The man who changed the world," right? This was the headlines, Steve Jobs. And I thought, wait a minute, iPhone, iPad, right? Apple computers, is that changing the world? And of course, there is some change there, but is it really change that in the end actually matters all that much? When I read that, I thought these people haven't really understood what changing the world actually means. Okay, the iPhone, maybe, it's nice to have an iPhone. It kind of looks good, right? It's kind of a status symbol or whatever. But sometimes you don't know what is good or bad, right? Maybe it just makes you more busy, or maybe it just hooks you up to more people or whatever. It makes life more difficult sometimes. So when I read that, I thought, yes, okay, Steve Jobs, obviously, somebody very intelligent, very smart in many different ways. He proved that throughout a long life. But still, it is very, very limited what he actually did for humanity. So these are the two things. If you are smart, yes, you can make your own life a little bit happier. You can make the life of other people a little bit happier. But it's very limited, right? So what about the Buddha? What is the difference between Steve Jobs and the Buddha? Just to make an unusual comparison. But anyway, the difference between Steve Jobs and the Buddha. Now the difference is that the Buddha discovered the meaning of life, right? He discovered the meaning of life. Now, what do you think is more important, iPhones or the meaning of life? This is your chance. If you get it wrong, then I'm not sure what to say. So there is, obviously, it's very clear, right? If you discover the meaning of life, you have discover something very profound, something extremely important. Who cares about the iPhone or the iPad compared to the meaning of life? If you understand the meaning of life, it's like suddenly things have a purpose, right? Thank you. One of the nice things about being a monk is everybody looks after you all the time. It's very, very beautiful. So the meaning of life is like, if you know what the meaning of life is, you know what the purpose of life is, you know what the aim is, you know what the goal is. When you know what the aim is, you can direct your whole life according to that aim, according to that goal. Suddenly everything has a sense of direction. Everything has a sense of purpose. Is that an iPhone? Or is it... No. Okay. So everything has a sense of purpose and direction. And not only that, so we can actually guide ourselves, we can move towards that, and hopefully we can even realize the purpose of life, the meaning of life. This is what everybody asks, this question, right? Why are we here? What are we doing this for? Okay, we get born, we go through life, we get educated, and then we die, and we look back, we think, okay, what was that all about, right? That's how people often think about life. So if you discover the meaning of life, it's obviously this is the most important question that anybody can ask and find an answer to. So obviously, that is what, in the end, makes the Buddha so special, because he understood the most profound question that anybody can ever ask. The meaning of life itself and the answer to that question. So what is it? In what sense do I mean by the Buddha discover the meaning of life? And this, of course, is the important question here. What does it actually mean? And what it means, if you want to ask yourself what the meaning of life is, you have to look inside of yourself. When you look inside of yourself, what do you find? What do you find? You find this kind of yearning, right? The desire, this kind of movement always towards something else. This is what the Buddha called craving, right? Tanha. There's this movement towards something all the time. We're trying to seek something. We're trying to get something. And usually that movement is always directed at external things in the world. So we go out there and we try to fulfill that yearning inside, that desire inside, by all kind of things, right? By finding the right religion, by getting the right education, by getting the right partner in life, by all kind of material things. All of these things in life are things that we desire and we crave for, and we're hoping that this will fulfill us, right? Look at the idea, when you crave for something, what is actually happening here? When you crave for something, what is happening is that craving tells you that if I get this thing that I'm craving for, I will be fulfilled. That's what it tells you, right? That's the feeling you have inside. But you know, every one of us knows from experience that actually you get that thing, and it's nice for a short while, and after a while it sort of fades away and the craving comes back again, right? So we keep on running after this thing, and it never delivers what it promises. And this is the problem of life, right? We yearn for something. We yearn for something there, some kind of happiness, something to fulfill us. And it doesn't actually fulfill the things that we are running after. And this is the problem. And the Buddha, and of course the reason, before I go back to the Buddha, the reason for this is because if you look inside of yourself, the problem is that it's like we have a hole inside of yourself. There's something missing inside of us. We don't feel complete, right? And we try to feel the sense of completion through acquiring external things, relationships, jobs, status, material things. All these things are how we try to fulfill the sense of hole inside of us. So look at that. That is the reason why we crave, because we don't feel fulfilled in life. We don't feel complete. There's something missing inside of us. And this, of course, is what the Buddha saw, right? He saw that there is this gap. But how can you fulfill what is a psychological lack? How can you fulfill that through external things? And I think it's very obvious when you think about it that if it is a psychological hole inside of you, and this is what all beings have to a more or less extent, if there's a psychological gap inside of you, you cannot fill that by external things. You have to work with your mind, you have to work with your heart, you have to work with your internal things instead. And this, of course, is precisely what the Buddha discovered, and he discovered the path to reach that sense of fulfillment, right? So what we do, we move away. We don't necessarily move away even, but we don't really, not so concerned about those external things anymore. Huh? Somebody was asking a question yesterday. Huh? I don't know if she's here today, but the world is so unfair, right? Sometimes you get what you want, sometimes you don't. People don't kind of give you the promotion that you're due in life and all these kind of things. And that's exactly right. The world is unfair. And you go for the external things, it never fulfills. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Even if it does, it doesn't really fulfill. The Buddha says there's something else. Go inside of yourself. And this is where you find that fulfillment. And it's very simple. And I think it is something that we all recognize once we are told these things. Sometimes it's strange with life, right? You have to be told, what is absolutely obvious to be able to see that actually is true. And this is what the Buddha did. He told us what is obvious. And what is obvious is that when you are kind, when you are a good person, when you are compassionate, when you are peaceful, then something inside of you changes, right? When you act with kindness externally, how do you feel? You feel good. You feel happy about yourself. And that is the inner thing that fulfills. And not only does it fulfill once, but the point, of course, is that if you do something good, it lifts you up a little bit. If you do something good again, it lifts you up again, right? It's like goodness builds on goodness, and it lifts you up gradually, stage by stage. At the same time, not only do you lift yourself up stage by stage by doing good things, at the same time you avoid doing the bad things. Now the bad things are these anchors, rocks that hold you down. So by cutting off the moorings to those rocks, again, it helps you to store up. And this is what this life is all about. You build up the goodness, and then what happens? What happens then is that you start to feel a sense of happiness, of contentment, of goodness inside. And that happiness, that contentment that you feel inside, it fulfills you, right? You start to feel fulfilled. You start to feel complete. That hole which is inside of us starts to get filled in. It's like somebody shoveling in dirt into a hole, and gradually is coming up. And you don't have that hole anymore because the hole is gone. The craving starts to disappear, right? We don't need this craving anymore. And when you have less craving, you start to feel more peaceful. When you feel more peaceful, you have more clarity. When you have more clarity, you know how to be moral. When you know how to be moral, again, you act in such a way that you become more kind in the future, right? You can see how the snowball kind of rolls on and becomes larger and larger, and this thing kind of rolls on by itself. It's a very, very powerful thing here. And this is how we find the sense of this is what contentment is all about, right? This lack of craving, this sense of internal having filled in that hole which is always there. Now we feel happy for the first time. Now we understand what the Buddha's teaching is all about. This is how it works. So if you want to come to the end of your life, and you don't want to look back and say, what was that all about? That was a strange experience. I went through all these things. Nothing really, you know, I did all these things, but now I'm going to die. So what about all these things from the past? They don't matter anymore. But if you feel that you have eliminated something, you die in a more content state than you were when you arose in this world, then you have moved towards something worthwhile, something that you can take with you into the future, something beautiful. And you don't wonder about the meaning of life anymore. This is the meaning of life, right? And then you feel content and complete. So this is what it's about. And of course, it goes beyond that as well. Not only is it about feeling that sense of contentment and completion inside, eliminating the irritation of craving, right? Craving is like an irritation which is always there, always demanding our attention, do this, do that. So that is part of it. Of course, it goes beyond that as well. But if you can even do that much, wow, you have lived a worthwhile life. And you're starting to actually understand the meaning of life for the first time. And this is what the Buddha pointed out. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that powerful? To me, it is so powerful that when I think about this, I think, what on earth else do I want to do? You know, why should I? And this is very nice when you're a monk. You better have that attitude when you're a monk, otherwise you're in serious trouble, right? So this is what I think. What on earth should I be doing except for this? This is the only thing that makes any sense. How can I be spending my life running around, doing all kinds of silly things, when this is the real meaning, this is the real purpose? So of course I want to be a monk. It gives you a sense of commitment, right? Because you know you're doing something which really is worthwhile. And I hope when I die, hopefully it's not going to happen quite yet, but you never know, right? You never know. But you know that when you're going to die, hopefully I will say, yes, I spent my life well. I moved towards the meaning of life, towards the goal of life. And then I will be very happy about what I've been doing here. So this is, in a sense, the Buddha's teaching. And this is what makes the Buddha so wise, right? This is what makes the Buddha a true genius, because he understood the real happiness in life. He didn't just give us the iPhone, he gave us something really profound, something really, really important, right? And this is why the Buddha is far more than Steve Jobs could ever be, or any genius in this world can ever be, because he actually discovered something very beautiful that really satisfied and really eliminates the problems of life. So this is how he was a true genius. This is what wisdom is all about. Wisdom is about solving the problems in life, solving real problems, solving suffering, moving one towards happiness. This is wisdom, right? Who do you take to be the wise people in your life? We all have kind of our wise people we go to. And the wise ones are the people who can sort of help us, right? When we go to them, we say, I have a problem, there's something I need to solve. And they will tell you something, they will say something you haven't perhaps thought of. And then you will do what they say, and you feel more at peace and more relaxed because of that. This is what wisdom is. But the Buddha has the ultimate answer to the ultimate question, what is the meaning of life? That is why he was so wise. And this is the beautiful thing about the Buddha's teachings. But not only was he wise, and this is, I think, the most important thing about remembering about the Buddha, that and why it is so powerful to be on the Buddhist path, because the Buddha had this particular insight. But that insight carries with it many other aspects as well. And one of the things that insight carries with it is the sense of compassion, right? The Buddha was also very compassionate. And this is the other thing which is so important to understand. Because when you understand the human condition, what you see, of course, is that you see all these people have this desire for peace, have this desire for fulfillment. We all want to move towards these things. I never ever met anybody who doesn't want to be happy. I think it's almost impossible. If you have a choice between being very depressed and very happy, what would you choose there? You obviously want to be happy, right? It's just so obvious. So this is where it goes towards. And the Buddha could see that. He could see because it was his own experience. He himself had suffered before his own awakening, right? And he sees that all these people around the world, everyone wants to be happy. Everyone wants to have fulfillment. And yet, they can't find it. And they mess it up. They do things wrongly. They think they're going to do things which are going to lead to happiness. And instead, they are moving towards suffering, right? This is almost like the tragedy of humanity here. If you look out into the world, how many people are there in the world who actually are on the path to happiness? And how many people are there who are moving towards ever more suffering? The vast majority are moving towards more suffering here. So think like that. You know, when you hear about some kind of suicide, crazy suicide bomber in the Middle East or whatever, don't get angry, just have compassion, because they are creating suffering not only for others, but also for themselves, right? They're being completely stupid. That's what it is. This is the power of delusion. And think about all that also about the people in your own life, the people in your workplace, the people in your family. There's always stupid people around us that do stupid things. Remember that they're creating suffering for themselves, right? Who wants to create suffering for themselves? Nobody wants to do that. We all want to be happy here. So we have to have compassion towards them because they don't know what they're doing here. And of course, the Buddha, having understood this to a deeper respect than anyone else in the whole world, he also had the most profound sense of compassion, right? And remember this. It's a very beautiful thing that the Buddha lived his last 45 years of his life purely out of compassion here. He had finished his own work, he had nothing more to do. The only reason why he traveled around the world, traveled around India, was to help other people, because he knew he had the answer to their problems, right? And this is such a powerful combination, two things, wisdom and compassion. The understanding of the root problem of humanity, the ultimate genius that can possibly exist, combined with a sense of compassion. You teach only to help. There's no other reason why you teach, right? So there's a sense you can trust these teachings. You can trust what the Buddha is talking about because it is coming from purity. It is coming from the right place. It is something very powerful. So this is the teacher that we have, right? Think about this teacher like that. Wisdom and compassion in the highest possible combination. Wow, that is very beautiful. And yet, at the same time, he was also a human being just like us. He's not a god. He's not some kind of, something completely on a different level which we can't understand. He's still a human being, so we can relate to him. And then, when you think of the Buddha like that, wow, it becomes so powerful. You read what he says in the suttas, in his discourses, you think, gee, this is, it becomes much more alive, much more beautiful, when you understand why he taught in the way that he was teaching. Wisdom and compassion. That is what it is all about. So think like that, and then you think like that, you recognize, you realize that he taught this path for us, and in a sense, we are all, every one of us, we're all the sons and the daughters of the Buddha, right? So think of yourself, I'm the son of a Buddha, I'm the daughter of the Buddha, right? Powerful. And then you think about that, and one of the things, one of the reasons why we are all children of the Buddha, in a sense, we are sons and daughters of the Buddha, is because when the Buddha taught his teachings 2,500 years ago, it was not just for the people around him, right, the people who were there. The Buddha always stated that his teaching, the idea of his teaching, was to last for a long time into the future. That is the purpose of these teachings. They were to go on. It's like you set rolling the wheel of the Dhamma, and once it starts rolling, itself propelling, it keeps going by itself. It's the power of the teaching that it keeps going by itself. Why? Because people hear it and they think, wow, this is profound, and they want to do it, right? And they get enlightened, and the next generation comes and says, wow, this is amazing, and it rolls on by itself like this, until eventually it kind of dies out because of various reasons. So the Buddha knew that, and because he knew that this wheel was going to keep going for a long time into the future, when he taught, he didn't just teach to his immediate disciples, he taught to everyone who comes afterwards. He was thinking of the people at the BF, right? I'm absolutely serious. He may not be thinking about us individually, but he had this idea of all these individuals, people like people, every one of you here today. He was thinking of the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery, right? He was thinking about me as well, probably, right? So every single one of us, we're all disciples, sons and the daughters of the Buddha. So think about that. That makes the suttas so much more powerful, because when you read the suttas and you think, he's talking to me, then you take it very seriously and you think, this is actually for me. These teachings are meant for someone exactly like myself. And then you investigate and you use your mind to try to understand what the Buddha is saying, because the teacher is in front of you. He's trying to say something powerful. Then you really apply yourself to try to understand what is going on. And of course, one of the wonderful teachings of the Buddha that I always found very inspiring also is when the Buddha says that the right way of paying respect to a teacher, and ultimately it's the Buddha, it can also be other teachers, but the right way of paying respect to a teacher is always to practice the teachings, right? It's not to worship them, or, I mean, bowing down is fine, but this is just a small little thing to help with your practice. The way to pay back your teacher is to practice the teachings and do the right thing and then realize the results. That's why you pay the teacher back. Yeah? So you read the suttas, you get inspired, you feel great about it, then you go back and you put them into practice. And then you are showing your respect to the Buddha in a real way, or any other teacher for that matter. And then it becomes so beautiful and so powerful. So this is essentially how we should relate to the Buddha. Relate to the Buddha as a guide. Relate to the Buddha as someone who shows the way in a beautiful way. And what is so nice about when you read the earliest suttas of the Buddha, the early discourses of the Buddha, you see the Buddha as a human being. And the Buddha often talks about his own life, right? And when you read the Buddha talking about his own life, remember that he's trying to teach you something, right? He's trying to say something about the Buddhist path. This is not just a life story like you can read in history. This is actually the Buddha teaching you. So read about the Buddha and allow it to sink in. Allow it to inspire you. Allow it to say, yes, I want to be like the Buddha. I also want to practice this way. I also want to realize the same things. I also want to do this thing. So make him into an inspiration, something that you try to live up to. And then you are using his teachings in the right way. Don't put them on the pedestal and worship them. Too many places to have all these suttas in like a cabinet, locked away. Nobody ever reads them, right? Everybody bows down to these teachings and they think that's being a Buddhist. That's not being a Buddhist at all. That's being superficial Buddhist. The real Buddhism is the Buddhism of the heart, right? The Buddha himself said, you don't know the Buddha by looking at the Buddha. You know the Buddha through realizing that those teachings that he taught. That's how you know the Buddha. Because when you realize them, then you understand what the Buddha is. Because then you have the same qualities as what the Buddha had. That is how you realize it. And that's how you make it real. So, inspire yourself is one of those things the life of any Buddhist or anyone who wants to do anything in the world. So we need inspiration. We need to kind of move ourselves forward, right? So do what it takes to inspire yourself. Sometimes after a long week at work, you may feel tired. You may the Buddhist teaching may be very far from your mind. So remember that when you feel like you need something, then do what it takes to inspire yourself to move you forward. Listen to a nice talk. Read a nice sutta. Read just the four little lines of the Dhammapada before you go to bed. Dhammapada is beautiful. Read four little lines of Dhammapada before you go to bed every night. And then fall asleep. Wow, that is beautiful. And you sleep well and you're happy. You wake up the next morning, right, full of energy and happy to move on into the future. So do these kind of things and then you become a blessing to yourself and also a blessing to everyone around you. And that is the best way we can live our lives. Okay. That's all I want to say for now. Thank you.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, we shall now have a Q&A. So, anybody has any urgent question for Ajahn to answer? There's a mic here, so you can put out your hands if you want to ask any question.
The Buddha said that if you want to be wise in the future, you have to ask questions. So you, this is exactly what he said. It's true. If you don't want to ask what I was talking about today, you can also broaden out the topics. You can ask about anything if you have anything you want to ask about. And I'm very easygoing. You can ask really naughty questions as well if you want to.
Good morning, Ajahn Brahmali. Perhaps if there was one book you would recommend to read, given there's such a variety of books on suttas, which one would you recommend that would not put people to sleep?
Okay. I cannot guarantee it won't put you to sleep, of course. That's unfortunately the case. But I think one of the best books that's available now is one that was called In the Buddha's Words, which is a translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. I think you have it here at BF, right? That's a very good one because it puts the suttas into categories, it organizes them in a system you can comprehend. It's progressive, it's full of beautiful introductions, full of beautiful notes to make you understand what's going on. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is, I would say, the best translator into English alive today. I was going to say apart from myself, but this is just called a self-bias, right? You always think that you're better. No, but I think he's the best one because his command of English is wonderful. His understanding of Pali is great, or the suttas. It's very, very hard to match Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. So he is the best and very well explained. So that is number one, I would say. And the second one, if you want to do something else, is to read the Dhammapada. Dhammapada is a very different type of work, but it can be very inspiring. You can read a verse now, a verse then, and it can be very beautiful and very uplifting and very inspiring. So sometimes one thing is to kind of learn the Buddha's teachings, which of course is very important. Right? We have to understand what's going on there. That's obviously a very important part of the Buddhist path. But there comes a point when you really know enough about what's going on, and all you need is inspiration to keep you going. And for inspiration purposes, the Dhammapada is very powerful and beautiful.
Well, it's good to know that you'll be translating some or have the aspiration to, because if you can produce smaller volumes, that's less intimidating for many people, I think.
No, I have no intention to translate anything here. No intention. I'm just messing around. I'm just being silly here.
Just for the benefit of everyone, there are 53 of us going for the Sutta and Meditation retreat that's going to be conducted by Ajahn Brahmali on the 24th. And there's one room left, so if any one of you has got the right conditions, could take that one last room. And of course, Ajahn Brahm's retreat in March, the early bird ends December 31st, so don't forget to make your registration. Thanks.
Okay, ask now or regret it later on. This is your chance.
So I have a simple question. You were saying we should put the practice in daily practice as a means to thank the teacher. What would you recommend as something simple to remember every day? Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sure you already know about all the precepts and all these kind of things, you know. And of course, everything really comes down to one thing, comes down to kindness. That's what everything comes down to. So kindness is so important on this path. If you can be kind, then you are fulfilling the precepts. Not only are you fulfilling the precepts, you're also purifying your mind, because the kindness is a mental thing. Purifying the mind is the same thing. So kindness is very important. So remember, always kindness. Be kind. And if you can't be kind because your mind is in the wrong state, you're feeling a bit grumpy or whatever, which happens to everyone, right? Okay, let's face it, we all feel grumpy sometimes. So if you do that, and you just kind of pull back a little bit, you don't say as much as you usually do, because you know if you open your mouth, the wrong things are going to come out, right? Sometimes we know that automatically. So, and this is kindness. But kindness, I think, is one of the most important things. But there's another thing which is very nice to remember, and this was what I was talking about a little bit during the talk, and that is the idea of death. We're going to die, right? And even if you are very young, I don't know who the youngest person here is, you're quite young. But even if you're very young, you're still going to die, right? It doesn't matter. It's still going to happen one day. So you might as well get it into your head now. If you're not prepared now, when are you going to be prepared? Now is the only time you can be prepared. You can't wait till tomorrow. And if you're not prepared now, the likelihood is that when it actually happens, you won't be prepared either. Now is the time to be prepared. And there's something very powerful that happens when you remember that you're going to die. Something very beautiful happens. What happens is that all the petty little things in ordinary life disappear, right? Imagine yourself on your deathbed. You have maybe a few hours left, right? People come in, people say something stupid. Are you going to get angry on your deathbed? Shut up, you know. It's not going to happen on your deathbed. On your deathbed, you will be at peace. You will forgive people. You will let go. Because you're out of here, right? You're going anyway. Who cares about what these people say? And you're just going to be peaceful. And also on your deathbed, are you going to think about kind of the next house you're going to buy? Are you going to think about the next relationship? Of course not. And this is what happens. This is the power of the death recollection. It takes away all those petty little things in daily life. It reminds you that your life on this, as a human being, is limited. It's only going to last so long, and then you're away and you're off. And I remember there was when I was in Brisbane a few years ago. There was a girl from Brisbane here. I'm not sure if she disappeared somewhere. Is she still here? Yeah, I'm not sure. Anyway. This man from Brisbane, he was actually of Sri Lankan background. He was a psychologist or something. And he said that every morning before he left his house, he reminded himself that I'm going to die here. And when he reminded himself that he's going to die, he knew that he would only leave the house in a good way, right? Leave after an argument with his wife or his kids or whatever, but always leave in a good way. He might not come back. Who knows what's going to happen when you go out during that day here? That is a beautiful way of using the recollection that you're going to die to make yourself more peaceful, to remember the priorities in life. What is actually important in life? You're going to die. Why on earth are you going to have that silly argument or silly disagreement about nothing here? So using that is actually a very useful one, and it is a contemplation that the Buddha recommended not just for monastics but for lay people as well. He specifically said that this is a contemplation for women and men and for householders and also for those who have gone forth. This is a universal contemplation, very powerful and useful for everybody. So use this, and you will find that it don't make it into something sad, right? Sometimes people think, oh, I'm going to die. Oh, that's terrible. No, I don't want to die. But don't think like that. Then it becomes useless. Use it to actually stimulate your spiritual welfare, your spiritual practice. Then it becomes very useful. Okay, so you can see that even the simple questions are really good ones. So please ask simple questions.
Thank you, Ajahn, for a very beautiful topic in the purpose of life, meaningful life. My questions will be on craving, because I catch from you now, just now, you talk about status and then also material and extra. And my question here is, let's say we are craving for status or material, but this craving is for the benefits of others. So how do you think about that? If let's say we want a status or material to help, sometimes if you don't have any status, you don't have power or authorized to do something for the benefit of others. Others just don't want to listen to you or something like that. And also if we don't have any material or in this kind of environment, especially in Singapore where status is very important in my opinion, how can we overcome this kind of craving, or is it bad or good or something like that? Thank you.
There's nothing inherently wrong with status. There's nothing inherently wrong with being wealthy, of course. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem, so you know, by all means, you know, be high status, be wealthy, you know, that's fine. But don't. There's no need to crave for those things, because even if you crave for them, often you can't get them, right? You might crave for it, but you can't get it anyway. So what's the point? Very often you find out if you don't crave it, it's actually a more powerful base for these things to come. Because when you don't crave, your mind is more clear. When your mind is more clear, you can make better decisions in life, right? All this craving in the mind is often not going to help you. You're going to work very hard, but often you're completely blind because the craving is kind of taking over. So that is the first point, is that craving often does not really help. The second point is that if people who look up to that kind of status, you know, people who think that status in society, money, wealth, this is a really important thing in life, it doesn't matter so much with those people, you know. You're not going to be able to convince them one way or the other anyway about spiritual values. The true people who are really worthwhile in the world are the people who understand that there is something more profound, something more deep. People who have respect for kindness, for virtue, for morality, for compassion. And these are the wise people in the world. These are the ones you're going to reach out to. And you will find that in a community like this, in the Buddhist Fellowship, or in a community like the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, people understand that. They understand that the people who really are to be respected are the ones who are virtuous and kind. Why is it that somebody like Ajahn Brahm is so, you know, famous? He's very famous, you know, almost everywhere now. It's almost too much of a good thing sometimes. You know, it's just, it's not bad in the sense that he himself has very strong personal integrity, so I don't think it affects him very much, but it gets very busy and he runs around and all this kind of thing. But anyway, that's a different thing. But what is it about Ajahn Brahm? He doesn't really have much worldly status, right? He doesn't have any money. He doesn't have any kind of really kind of official positions or anything. He's just this ordinary man. When he walks into the room, his robe is kind of hanging all over the place, right? But that is what is so beautiful about him, right? That is what is so wonderful. Here is this monk who is so accomplished in so many ways, and he takes himself so unseriously. He doesn't care about what he looks like to the rest of the world. That is what is so wonderful. And you respect that when you say it. And you respect the kindness, you respect the virtue, the wisdom of something coming like that. But these are the people you want to reach out to. Forget about those people who, you know, who look up to state, the ordinary status in the world, because it doesn't matter with those people anyway. They're going to have to run after their own things and do their own things. And what you will find is that even those people, when they see an example that is very unusual and very profound and very kind of grabs hold of your attention, you know, some person who is special, even they, not all of them, but some of them will actually understand that there's something here which is very beautiful and very profound. So often what we need to do is we need more examples of people who are beautiful, who are pure, who are compassionate. This is what we need in the world. And those people who are ready, when they see that example, they will be inspired and they will start following the same path. This is the power of someone like Ajahn Brahm. People can see that there's something there which is very beautiful and very profound, right? And that's why when he goes to Korea, he speaks on the football stadiums because so many people want to see him, primetime television, these kind of things. Because everybody wants to have a piece of the action, right? So you have to do it in this kind of way. And that's beautiful when that works. And it's very powerful. And those people who are ready, they will see that. Have I even remotely answered your question? Or have I?
Okay, we can have two more questions for Ajahn.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. There's a question here. Please ask your question out of compassion for all of us.
Ajahn Murali, could you speak a little bit about how the Buddha addressed his own parents when he left home out of search for meaning of his for everyone and himself, as well as after he got the enlightenment and he came back to Kapilavastu to meet his dad?
Yeah, okay. Okay. So, yeah, that is actually quite an important topic because the way this is described in the suttas, the way it is described, the way the Buddha actually described this himself compared to the way it is told in later literature actually is quite different. And the way you find in later literature is basically the Buddha left in the middle of the night while his wife and child were sleeping. He went on a horse and he rode out, not into the sunset, but into the night. So basically, that's what, and people often ask, right? You get the Christians, they say, well, you know, this Buddha of yours, he has no compassion, he just leaves his wife and child, right? This is what they often say, and they try to sort of tell you that the Buddha is no good because of this. But the interesting thing is that story is not actually how the Buddha explained how he went forth. What the Buddha says, when you read the well-known sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, which means the noble search, and the Buddha talks about his search for awakening, right? And then he says that when he left the home life with his mother and father were crying, right? Just like all of us, when we leave the home life, our parents never like it, right? I had the same problem. I think everybody has the same problem. After a while, they get the point. It's actually something very good and beautiful. But in the beginning, parents don't often like this. But the point is that his parents were there, right? They were sorrowing just like any other parents were, which means that he would have had to have talked to them. He was telling them, look, I'm going to go forth. This is my decision in life. And of course, if you have a son who's going to become the future Buddha, chances are you're going to be pretty attached to him, right? He's going to be pretty special. So of course, you are a bit sad when he's leaving the home life. What it also means is that he would have talked to his parents about his wife and his child. He would have told them that, you know, can you look after him in this, you know, when I leave the home life? So it wasn't, such a disastrous thing as it looks like in the later literature. So this is the first point, right? The Buddha actually did the right thing when he left the home life. This is point number one. Now, the second point, of course, is that according to the Buddha's teachings, the best way to repay your parents is not, you know, all these things that we do from them in a material sense. This is, of course, important. And I encourage all of you to look after your parents, especially as they get older. It's a very important part of the Buddhist path. And it's a very powerful type of karma that you can make by looking after your parents. So please do that. And I know that there are some very good examples here. People look after their parents really hard. So, That is important. But the Buddha said that if you really want to help your parents, the best way is to establish them on the spiritual path, right? Because if you can establish your parents on the spiritual path, you're giving them some nourishment, not only for this life, but for future lives, for everything. You're giving them something much more powerful. You're giving them the triple gem. These are gems, right? Something very deep. They're going to nourish them and give them a sense of true happiness in life. So this is what we really should be doing. Now, if you go forth and you become a monastic, and even though your parents may be crying, they say, okay, if you have to do it, go, you know, whatever. And even if that happens, later on it will pay off for your parents. Later on they will understand that this was something beautiful. And this is what happened with the Buddha, just as you're saying, Lai Peng. You know, the Buddha then goes back and visits his family after a few years, and then he teaches them, and his son goes forth, and according to later commentaries, I think his father also attains some sort of attainment because of that, and his ex-wife, she goes forth and becomes a nun and an arahant. So you can see the power when somebody goes forth and the kind of ramification it has for your family. And the same thing also happened to me. When I started off, my parents weren't exactly thrilled that I was going to become a Buddhist monk, to say the least. They thought I was a bit crazy to become a Buddhist monk. And fair enough, you know, I don't blame them for that because they don't understand what being a Buddhist monk is all about. But later on, they have changed their mind. They have come to understand there's something very beautiful about this path. I treat them well now. I didn't treat them well before, right? That's already one big bonus already. Yeah. So, and this is the sort of thing that kind of touches your parents' heart. This is the sort of language they can understand, right? And then you do that, and then they see that you're happy, you're content in a monastic life, and then they come to you and they say, oh, maybe you should teach us a little bit about the Buddha's teachings. Maybe teach us a bit about meditation practice, right? And that's what I say, yes, this is it. These things are happening, going the right way. And that's when I can pay back my parents fully, and even more than pay them back, said the Buddha, if you can teach them the Dhamma in this way here. So this is, so please remember that. So if you have a child who wants to go forth, don't say no. Say, hooray, well done. You know, go for it. Don't feel bad. It's always difficult to be a parent. I know what it's like. Of course, you have attachments to your children. We all have attachments to each other. But try to look at the big picture. And when you see the big picture, you see something very beautiful and very wonderful going on. Particularly if they want to go to a good monastery, then it's really great. Okay, are you happy with that, my thing? Yeah? Okay, very good.
Few more questions, so do you have any question?
Can I have a question, Ajahn? No, because it's a side question, because I read from your biography that you actually travelled to Australia when you heard the word Brahm. What is it all about? Yeah. I was quite curious about it. When you heard the word Brahm, you actually went to Australia to find Ajahn.
Yeah.
So why did the word Brahm actually inspire you?
Well, it's not the word Brahm. It's the word of Brahm. It was just a joke that I said many years ago that somehow seems to have gotten stuck here. So the point was that I heard a teaching about Ajahn Brahm. I was in England at the time, and I was at the Chithurst Monastery, which Ajahn Sumedho established in the UK. And I heard a teaching about Ajahn Brahm, and straight away I knew this is my teacher. I just had to read the teaching. I thought, this is it. And that's what I meant by hearing the word of Ajahn Brahm. I had to go to Australia. And sometimes it's amazing, because sometimes you don't know. You know, this was just my intuition that this was the right thing. You can't really know what it actually is. But of course, it turned out to be very right. And I have, for that reason, I've been there ever since in Australia. Yeah. Yeah, there's something, it's good to have a teacher you feel you can relate to, right? We all have different needs, we're all slightly different. And some people relate better to some teachers, other people relate better to other teachers. And it's fine to choose your teacher, you don't have to have anybody specific as your teacher. Have someone who actually you feel speaks your kind of language, you can understand what they're talking about, and the person that you can have faith in. So that is more important.
So a follow-up question on that, how do we choose the right teacher? Or how do we follow the right teacher? Because there's so many teachers around.
Yeah. Okay, so this is that's a very important question. In the end, it is about your own ability, your own wisdom, basically. That's what it comes down to. What sort of wisdom have you got? And if you have enough wisdom yourself, then you can choose a teacher wisely, right? So the criteria for choosing a teacher is basically to look at the person and to see the qualities in that person. That's essentially what it comes down to. And you see this in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha. The Buddha himself said quite literally, you should look at me and you should see if you can see any defilements in me. Do I have anger? Do I have greed? Do I have delusion? And that is what you should look for. So this is what everybody should look for. We should look for a teacher, someone with integrity. Somebody who has the right qualities, right? If you have no anger, what are you going to be like? What do you think? You're going to be kind, right? Okay, so you're going to be kind. Because you have no anger, you cannot come from kindness. This is the flip side of not having anger. If you have no desire, you're going to be very generous with your time, very kind of open-hearted, always giving to other people, right? There's the flip side of not having too much desire and also being very easy to look after, right? No delusion. It means you have a sense of wisdom. You listen to somebody and you say, yeah, they're actually saying something very interesting here, right? They're kind of touching me on a deep level I haven't heard before. So these are the signs you look for. And you look for that over a period of time. You're not satisfied. You keep on looking. Because sometimes it's very hard to catch these things. Sometimes people can sort of play the part for a while. But after a while, the defilements, if they're there, they will come out. And they will show themselves. So you have to be honest. And you have to be alert. And you have to be aware. And then you look at those things. And then you place your faith where the faith is worthy of being placed in. And this is how you do it. And then, of course, you read the suttas yourself. One of the wonderful things about Buddhism, which I think is actually, I maybe should have said in my talk as well, that the great thing about having the Buddha as your teacher means that we move away from the personality worship, right? It's so easy in Buddhism, in any kind of religion, to worship and to honor individuals too much. It is not about individuals. In the end, it's the Buddha is our teacher. And the power of that is that you get away from this very dangerous thing of attaching too much to a particular teacher. What if that teacher goes wrong, right? And I know so many cases of teachers who have gone wrong and who have abused their disciples and who have done all kind of crazy things, and the student loses complete faith in not only that person, but all the Buddhas, right? And never come back again because they feel so distraught at the bad conduct of that particular teacher. And this is the power of having kind of final faith in the Buddha himself. Because that is not going to change. The Buddha is there. He's dead. He has shown that he has integrity. So by reading the suttas and understanding them, and then also using those to help you decide who is the right teacher, right? The Buddha got it right. So if somebody contradicts the Buddha, well, you know that something can't be quite right with the way they're teaching. It should match, basically, what the Buddha taught. So there's something very powerful about having the Buddha as your kind of root, final teacher. And of course, it is not often enough just to have the Buddha. We also need to see the live example. When you see the live example, you think, yeah, it works, right? Just reading a few words on the page is too kind of theoretical. But when you see the person, when you see it actually works, that also, of course, is important as well. So the two together come together very beautifully here. Yeah.
Last one, yeah.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahmani. So it's very interesting to hear how you explain to us about this Buddha and all that. So may I just ask some personal question that if you can share with us. I know that you come from a Western country to embrace the Buddha teaching. It's a so-called Asian culture. So maybe you can share with us what really inspired you in the beginning to become, to learn about Buddhist teaching, and at the end, to become a monk. Maybe this can a little bit inspire us later to enter the monkhood.
That's wonderful, isn't it? Are you a candidate for becoming a monk? that's great. This is one of the things that I kind of wanted to bring out in the Buddha's teaching, is that it speaks across time and across culture, right? This is the beautiful thing about these teachings. They're not really related specifically to Indian culture or to the time period 2,500 years ago. It speaks to the human heart. It doesn't matter where you come from, you know, whether you are from, I was born in Norway, whether you're born in Norway or you're born in Tibet or you're born in Afghanistan or you're born in Africa or Singapore, so what? The human heart is basically the same. And you can see that. We all want more money. We all want more happiness in one way or another. We're driven by the same things. We have the same fears, the same problems in life. And that is what is so powerful about this sutta. As you can see, that speak to you, regardless of where you come from, regardless of who you are, regardless of your background. So in the end, this is what I found so powerful when I was reading this. Of course, why I became a Buddhist and why I became a monk, I don't really know why I became a Buddhist, why I became a monk. It just seemed natural to me. It seemed like the right thing, right? There's something there. There was nobody in my family, none of my friends or anybody I knew who were Buddhist. But when I was in my early 20s, I wanted to go to Asia. So I had a chance as a student to go to Japan when I was 21. So I went to Japan on this exchange program, and I worked for there over a few weeks during the summer. And when I was there, I read my first book on Buddhism, right? I went to all the Buddhist temples. Why? Why these things? And the only way I can explain it, it's very likely that I was a Buddhist in a past life. I was probably an Asian in a past life, right? Very, very likely. And I was a Buddhist. So this is the only explanation I have. But for me, it was very natural. And then when I went back to Norway, one of my very best friends, who later on became a very successful businessman, he had a book on meditation practice. So he said to me, okay, here you are, you know, check this out, right? It was called that book? It was called, I don't think I necessarily would recommend it, it probably was rubbish, but he became a very famous writer of meditation books. He was an American layperson, and it was basically about breath meditation, right? What was his name? Wilson or something like that? It's 30 years ago since I read it, so I can hardly remember now, but Ralph Wilson or something like that. The Calm Technique, that was the name of the book. The Calm Technique, yeah. And basically breath meditation, I tried it out, and I got some good results, right? I felt this actually works. Now that was a thing which really turned me around, because, okay, all the theory, all seeing the Buddha statue, all that kind of thing, okay, fine, that's good, and there's something familiar with that, but actually doing it, and seeing that it works, wow, that was the most powerful thing. And then later on in my life, that memory was kind of stuck in me, right? And later on, I went on to study. I studied in London for a couple of years, and I traveled around. I wasn't very happy. I studied finance, of all things, right? And the finance world is always about money, 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 about status, about all these kind of things. I just didn't like it at all. I studied it more because it just, I don't know, this kind of default, like many of us, we're kind of on this kind of, you know, we don't really know what we're doing. We're just kind of traveling a course, and it just sort of happens by itself. But I wasn't happy. I realized I wasn't happy. But I knew that when I meditated, I was happy. And this is actually where my heart really inclined towards. So I decided, let me try this more. So I went to a monastery eventually in England, and that's how gradually I moved in that direction. And of course, after a while, when you start to really get into the teachings of the Buddha, and ultimately, it's basically, it becomes clear to you, this is what it's all about. This is the meaning of life, right? Why on earth did I mess around with studying finance for before? Okay, actually, I don't regret that. Everything comes in handy at some point. But it becomes very clear that this is what life is about. This is what I want to do. And now that is what is sustaining me. Basically, the idea that I feel, for me, it is very clear that this is what it's all about. Yeah. Are you happy with that? Yeah?
Shall we say sadhu three times for the interactive question and answer session? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Can I request Ajahn to help us in doing the share of merits? And because today is also a very auspicious day in the Chinese lunar calendar, it's actually the winter solstice. In Chinese, it's called the Dongzi, where the family members will have a reunion dinner and eat those rice ball thingy. Yeah. So I think it's a very good day for us to share our merits with our family and loved one and departed one as well. Yep.
Do you want me to chant then?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Etavata chaangehi sambhata punya sambhata sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sankhati sthitiya edang menyati nang hotu sukhita hotu nyatayo edang menyati nang hotu sukhita hotu nyatayo edang menyati nang hotu sukhita hotu nyatayo. Should I read it?
Yeah.
Okay. I dedicate the merits which I have accumulated to the cultivation of my mind in order to bring happiness and benefits to all sentient beings. I dedicate the merits to my parents, my spouse, my children, my relatives, friends, colleagues, my adversaries, wishing them long life, good health, happiness and prosperity. May we never part from the triple gem. May we always walk the path towards enlightenment. Okay. Arahang Sama Buddha Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavanta Abhivadami Vakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namastami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.
Ajahn would like to dedicate merits to you for your good health and long life so that you can come back to Buddhist fellowship and give us more teachings. Yeah. Okay, shall we all pay true respect to Ajahn for the wonderful teachings? Yep. Thank you. Okay, do you mind trying to make a way for Ajahn so that